Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to this month's issue of Critical Decisions in Emergency Medicine podcast. With you is Dr. Danya Koja. I'm an emergency physician who practices in Baltimore, Maryland, and all over the world.
And I'm Wendy Chang, an emergency physician and neurointensivist in Baltimore, Maryland.
And today we're going to be talking about April's Critical Decisions in Emergency Medicine publication. And if you're not familiar with Critical Decisions in Emergency Medicine publication, what are you waiting for? It is ASEP's official CME publication, and it contains phenomenal things. My favorites are usually the two lessons, which focus on critical decisions that you have to think of in the emergency department, whether bread and butter emergencies or things that are cutting edge.
There are also a lot of other pearls in the critical EKG. Critical pediatrics, our newest feature, and as our listeners know, my favorite, the LLSA review.
And for our first lesson today, we have higher ground, high altitude illness. Thank you to the authors, Drs. Jeffrey Comp and Jerome Rogich. So let's talk about being high, or more like it, having high altitude illness. And that usually encompasses three things, which is acute mountain sickness, high altitude cerebral edema, which is HACE, and high altitude pulmonary edema, which is HAE.
Well, you know, Danya, that I don't like high altitudes. Because remember when we went to Copper Mountain and I could barely breathe or go up the steps? I really understood what ischemic chest pain felt like then.
I wish I could remember. I was probably slumped on the floor next to you because I hated being at such high altitude. It was so awful. I would go up the steps and I'd get tachycardic, feel like I'm dying. And that was my first experience with altitude. And I mean, Copper was pretty tough. It was 3,700 meters, which is like really high. And
we're both like sea level girls.
Yes. Yes, we are. Except that the more we read critical decisions, we don't want to eat anything from the sea. But that's a whole other conversation. So in this lesson about high altitude, we're going to be talking about the manifestations of high altitude illness, risk factors, acclimatization, prevention, and management.
Okay, so let's start with the basics. What is it and when does it happen?
So high altitude illness usually happens when you are at a level that's higher than 1500 meters. And the higher you are, the more likely you are to get it. And it happens at 25% of people above 3500 meters, which totally makes sense, except that in our case, it was 100% of you and me. So with acute mountain sickness, it is headache, nausea, vomiting, difficulty sleeping, lightheadedness, all sorts of like non-specific but really iffy symptoms. With high altitude cerebral edema or HACE, which is what we're going to call it for the rest of this lesson, it's things like headache, confusion, ataxia, but the big one is altered mental status, HAPE, which is the pulmonary edema, is a non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema where you're, you know, hypoxic and can't breathe, which are pretty self-explanatory. And these things occur because you have systemic hypoxia because of the decreased barometric pressure of oxygen. So your body doesn't get enough oxygen and that sucks. So.
Gotcha. Are there any risk factors for these?
So we don't really know why some people specifically get it and some don't. It seems that there's like a genetic predisposition. Things like having a previous history of high altitude illness and having lots of alcohol or taking sleeping aids, all of these things can make you more likely to get it. There are things that protect you from that, such as, you know, if you live at high altitude, and actually if you are older, which is one of the few things that get better when you are older.
Nice. That's something to look forward to.
So are you saying that when we're older, it's going to hang out in Copper Mountain, you and I?
Maybe not Copper Mountain, but we can not stay at sea level anymore.
Okay, sounds like a plan.
Well, what is acclimatization? Because I remember this term when I was reading about traveling to Peru.
Well, acclimatization is the gradual physiologic adjustment of the body to that environmental hypoxia over days to weeks. Simply put, hypoxia leads to increased ventilatory response, and therefore you have hypercapnia because you're breathing so much. Then your kidney decides to produce a whole bunch of bicarb. Now, the problem is that you can also have pulmonary hypertension, which can lead to pulmonary edema, which is not really helpful. Hypoxemia can also lead to increased cerebral blood flow, which can lead to vasogenic edema. These two elements are when your body does not acclimate well, and instead it ends up having those illnesses, which we're talking about.
Do you have any pearls for the diagnoses of these conditions?
Well, the big thing is that they're clinical diagnoses. There's no test or thing that you do to find that out. So that's why you have to have a high clinical suspicion. Some people try to come up with a scoring system. Actually, there's a ton of scoring systems to diagnose acute mountain sickness. And the one that's mentioned in the article, and it's actually in one of the tables, is the Lake Louise scoring system. However, at the end of the day, you must maintain a high clinical suspicion because they can look at like a whole bunch of things. Specifically, acute mountain sickness can look like it's carbon monoxide poisoning, dehydration, viral infection, physical exhaustion, just a good old hangover, or something like heat exhaustion. Something to also keep in mind that's incredibly important is that sometimes HACE and HAPE can be an extension of acute mountain sickness. So somebody can have acute mountain sickness and then it can get worse into HACE and HAPE, or they can just develop on their own. And there's a figure in the article that summarizes the clinical features of all three illnesses.
Is there anything we can do to prevent these from happening?
Yeah, just don't go anywhere that's high. That's really it.
That is the solution.
I mean, it works.
True.
But if you really have to, then ascending gradually is your big thing, or the big way that you can actually make this happen. The recommended ascent rate is actually less than 300 meters a day, with a rest day for every 1,000 meters when you're traveling above the 3,000 meters. So you should just basically take your time. If that's not possible, because in all reality, you can't always do that, then one other solution is to take acetazolamide, which is carbonic anhydrase inhibitor. And the whole point is that it increases the excretion of the bicarb. So you develop this metabolic acidosis / respiratory acidosis situation. And therefore, you increase your mid ventilation and then increase your PaO2. Another thing that you can do is to give dexamethasone for acute mountain sickness or HACE and nifedipine for HAPE, but the data is not that perfect.
Gotcha. How do we treat these?
So the treatment is to stop ascending and give the patient symptomatic treatment. So for example, NSAIDs for their headaches and so on. And then if you can descend, then do it. If you can give them oxygen, then do it. Now you can also give them some medications to try to treat. Acetazolamide may work. Dexamethasone may also work for moderate to severe acute mountain sickness. For HAPE, you can consider nifedipine and maybe phosphodiesterase inhibitors. And if it is impossible for them to descend, or the descent is going to be delayed, then considering hyperbaric oxygen is going to be essential.
Awesome. Thank you, Dania. I learned a lot from this article and you taking us through it. I learned that high altitude illnesses can actually occur even at altitudes of just greater than 1500 meters. But of course, the risk of this happening is higher as you go up in higher elevation. The symptoms are sometimes quite nonspecific, like headache, nausea, vomiting. And so you really have to have a high index of suspicion, like you mentioned, to consider things like carbon monoxide poisoning, general exhaustion from climbing these mountains, or even a hangover or heat exhaustion. While we can avoid going to these high altitude places, some people may not be able to. And so gradual ascent is a way to prevent this. And you can also consider things like acetazolamide to help with kind of this acclimatization process. Treatment, though, is important that you have to stop the ascent and start descending with, of course, supplementation of oxygen and even maybe dexamethasone for moderate to severe symptoms, nifedipine for HAPE.
Well, that's a great summary. And now let's move on to something a little different. Critical procedures, which is misplaced subclavian central venous catheters.
Well, we certainly place a lot of subclavians in the neuro ICU, but I think we've all had cases where our central lines don't go where exactly we want it to go.
Yeah, so the problem is that they don't always listen, and sometimes we got to fix that. And apparently yelling at it and telling it to fix itself does not work. So you got to actually just either exchange it over a wire while using a brand new kit, and that gives you a smaller risk of infection. Or if you are not able to do that, or you realize that right after you put it in, then you can just withdraw it and redirect. One way to do that is to use a balloon-tipped Fogarty catheter to help float the central venous catheter into the correct position. The other one is to compress the IJ and possibly even have a helper whose job is to just compress the internal jugular so that you're not actually going up there. Another way is to also use the ultrasound to visualize where you're going to confirm that you're going in the right direction. And although our procedure today is talking about fixing the misplaced catheter, you can actually use any of these tips to prevent that from happening in the first place.
Absolutely. Great tricks.
And moving on to our critical image, which is a case of throat pain after eating fish.
In this case, the patient ended up having negative x-rays and even laryngoscopy, and it took a CT to show that a fishbone was actually lodged in the patient's throat. So remember that radiography, like lateral neck x-rays and chest x-rays, are not that sensitive, reported to be anywhere from 44 to 80% sensitive, but has an almost 100% specificity. If you find the fishbone on x-ray, then there's no need for a CT unless you have concerns about complications, but CT is 100% sensitive. Contrast is not needed unless you're concerned about abscess or vascular injury, and the treatment is endoscopy to remove the fishbone. No more fish for any of us either.
Oh, come on. You cannot take fish away from me. After last month, what were we not allowed to eat? Everything. Everything.
Yeah, I know. I can't even think of anything.
Yeah, because chicken is going to be salmonella. The fish is going to be the bones. And did I tell you I ate jellyfish the other day?
You did. Did you like it?
Yes, it was actually really good because it's kind of tasteless. So it just tastes like whatever sauce you have with it. I'm pretty sure that now, in like a month or two, you're going to say I'm not allowed to eat jellyfish anymore. So I'm not sure what to do. But the good thing is that they don't have bones. So therefore, this would not be a problem.
Exactly. But we'll move on to our critical cases in orthopedics and trauma this month. It's a case of a patient who has comminuted and displaced humeral shaft fracture after a fall. And they actually used the unaffected extremity, the other arm, to measure the length of the padding and the plaster for their coaptation splint, which I thought was a really great idea and reminder. And there's a great figure in the article that shows what a coaptation splint is and how you also use a sling to support the wrist, because the goal is to keep the elbow unsupported so that you can have traction on that fracture.
Definitely important to remember that humeral shaft fractures have a bimodal distribution with age. So in the young, they happen with like your high energy trauma, or with older adults because of osteopenia. Compartment syndrome can happen. And then the other important complication would be radial nerve palsy, which can happen in like 10% of cases. So that's a lot if you think about it, like 1 out of 10. The majority of these patients, or the majority of these fractures actually, heal successfully non-operatively. If they're open, if they're comminuted, if there's vascular injury, if there's a brachial plexus injury, if they have multiple arm fractures, so they also have a forearm fracture at the same time, or of course, if they have a compartment syndrome, those would be reasons for us to do surgery. Other than that, they tend to heal well without any surgery.
A similar case actually came up recently, exactly about a humeral shaft fracture and what to do with it. So I think all of us need to read this critical decisions issue to remind ourselves.
Definitely. And moving on to something that is also pretty critical, which is our critical EKG. And in this case, it's an ST elevation that's present in AVR and AVL. And the ST elevation in AVR is more than it is in V1. And that is concerning for a left main occlusion. Respect the AVR.
That's very true. Can we get a t-shirt with that?
Respect the AVR. Well, I'm still waiting for my Versed t-shirt. You know how much I love Mendazolam. So once I get that, then we can do the AVR t-shirt.
Gotcha.
So moving on to our second lesson of this issue, which still fits in with our whole like environmental being out in the wild theme. It's called pest control, tick and mosquito-borne illnesses. Thank you to Drs. David Della Giacina, Ann Fox, and Samantha Siegel for writing this article.
Definitely, because warmer weather in our area definitely means more bugs, and I'm not a fan of ticks or mosquitoes or these associated diseases.
Yeah, unfortunately, mosquitoes really love me, and they are a fan of me. I am one of those people where if like you're walking and I'm in the midst of like 1,000 people and there is one mosquito, it will find me.
I'm going to travel with you then.
What? I'm going to be like your mosquito candle?
Yes, exactly.
well, tell me more about this since I'm going to be the victim to all of these mosquito illnesses and they present with non-specific symptoms. So what are we going to talk about today?
Well, we're going to talk mostly about Lyme and then also mention some other tick-borne illnesses like babesiosis. And we'll also talk about West Nile virus, one of the mosquito-borne illnesses.
All right, so let's start with Lyme disease. How do these patients present?
Well, remember that there's three stages to Lyme disease. There's the early localized stage, early disseminated stage, and the late disseminated stage. And that classic erythema migrans, or that bullseye rash, is the hallmark finding of this early localized infection. Seen in up to 80% of patients and happens 1 to 2 weeks after the tick bite. And it is the only symptom that in isolation that is diagnostic for Lyme disease. So if you find erythema migrans, you should treat for Lyme. After that, the patient can develop this nonspecific flu-like illness. And then if it's not treated, then of course they can progress into the early disseminated infection that predominantly presents with skin findings, cardiovascular findings, and neuro findings. They can have a similar rash that's disseminated erythema migrans, but it's smaller and there's no central clearing. And cardiovascular findings, we always hear about it on boards, which is myocarditis, heart blocks. In terms of neuro findings, the most common presentation is facial palsy, but they can also have encephalitis, meningitis. And when we talk about late disseminated infections, that's when we're talking about the mono or polyarthritis that's more than 6 months after the tick bite.
All right. So those are quite a variety of symptoms. How are we supposed to treat the patients with Lyme disease?
Well, if the tick is still attached to the patient, you want to remove it. So remember that we're always taught to use tweezers and hold it as close to the skin as possible so you can remove, you know, the majority of the tick. If you do have some remaining tick parts, it's okay. It should not be scraped because they really don't transmit the Lyme disease. In terms of antimicrobials, doxycycline is our first line antibiotic, but you can also use amoxicillin, ceftriaxone. And so the duration of treatment is really depending on, of course, what stage of infection you're dealing with. If you're dealing with early localized infections, such as the erythema migrans, you're going to treat for 14 days. And then when you move to early disseminated disease like Lyme carditis, you may have to treat up to 3 weeks, 21 days. And then if you're dealing with the late disseminated Lyme with arthritis, then these patients are going to need treatment for up to a month, 28 days, and potentially even IV antibiotics and, of course, inpatient admission if they're not responding appropriately.
Got it. All right. Those are great reminders of what to do immediately after the tick bite and how to treat Lyme disease. But the problem is that Lyme is not the only disease that we have to think about with ticks. What are other tick-borne illnesses that we should consider?
That's right. There are a lot of tick-borne illnesses, and they're a mouthful. The article mentions a few like babesiosis, anaplasmosis, and ehrlichiosis. And so they all can present, of course, with very nonspecific symptoms like fevers, chills, fatigue, myalgias.
And osis.
Yes, and osis. Exactly. So they can definitely be really hard to differentiate, and you're going to need, you know, PCR testing to really figure out which one's which. A few pearls, though, are that in babesiosis, the incubation period is much longer. So a lot of times patients don't actually remember the tick bite because the incubation period can be up to 9 weeks or more. In anaplasmosis, it can present as co-infections with Lyme or Rocky Mountain spotted fever. So sometimes they can have a rash because of that. And it's more severe in immunocompromised patients. And then ehrlichiosis, we often learn about the classic Lone Star tick that can transmit this disease, but it only accounts for 35% of infections. It's more commonly transmitted by the deer tick in the Midwest and Southeastern Canada. Their symptoms are also very similar to all these non-specific flu-like illnesses, but can have CNS involvement and therefore also higher mortality.
So how do we evaluate for these tick-borne diseases? You did mention PCR testing to differentiate all of those crazy things, but what else can we do that's more accessible to us in the ED?
Yeah, so basic labs like CBC, electrolytes, renal, and liver functions can give you some ideas, but they are very nonspecific. The article definitely goes through each of those tick-borne illnesses and some general lab findings that can suggest one versus another, so take a look at those. And the article also goes through antimicrobial treatment for each of these tick-borne illnesses.
All right, so let's move on to mosquito-borne illnesses. Tell us about West Nile virus and why we should be concerned about it.
Well, West Nile virus is related to dengue and yellow fever, and it's actually the most common domestically acquired arbovirus infection. They're commonly transmitted by mosquitoes, but can also be transmitted in transplants and transfusions, though, of course, those cases have decreased with screening for this. The scary thing about this is it can be neuroinvasive, so people can die from this, and the majority of the patients are actually asymptomatic, and so the numbers reported are actually probably underestimating the real prevalence.
So how does West Nile virus present? And let me just point out that we are talking about an environmental illness, and you have already talked not once, but now this is going to be your second time talking about neuro stuff.
Yes, exactly.
So knock yourself out.
Yes, agreed. Most cases of West Nile virus occur in the late summer to the early fall, but it can be year-round in milder climates. 80% of these infections are asymptomatic, as I kind of alluded to. And the majority of them who do have present with symptoms will present with West Nile fever. And neuroinvasive disease is actually, you know, less than 1%, so not terribly common. The symptoms include fevers, fatigue, difficulty concentrating, and a nonspecific macular papular rash. The other scary thing about this is even with mild disease like West Nile fever, patients can have a prolonged recovery, even up to a year. With neuroinvasive disease, these patients can present with meningitis, encephalitis, or even acute flaccid myelitis. Some risk factors are those who are older than 50 years old, those with diabetes, alcohol use, organ transplant, immunosuppression of some sort. And there's even been cases of rare manifestations reported of rhabdo, hepatitis, myocarditis.
Well, this sounds pretty scary. How are we supposed to diagnose West Nile virus?
It really takes a high clinical suspicion. If you get a travel history that is concerning based on the areas they were in, that may help. Because laboratory studies are quite nonspecific, if they're presenting with neurological symptoms and you do a LP, the CSF can show elevated protein and pleocytosis. You can get serum and CSF serology, but the IgM can remain positive in previously infected or exposed people in endemic areas. And even the PCR has low utility since the virus moves quickly into the CNS. So really hard to diagnose.
All right. Well, this is sounding scarier by the minute. Well, how are we supposed to fix it? What's the treatment?
For now, it is still mainly supportive treatment. Antivirals and IVIG have been studied, and there has been no significant effect from those. You can certainly try and prevent West Nile virus infections with screening donors, as I mentioned, from transplants and blood transfusions, or mosquito precautions. There is a vaccine in development, though, so there's some hope.
Okay, so this is going to be my second t-shirt. Actually, you know what? I want this to be my first t-shirt, is vaccines.
Yes, everybody should wear that.
Yes, I agree. Well, thank you for taking us through this article that has quite a few reminders of things that we don't necessarily see on a regular basis, especially depending on where we live, I guess. It was a great reminder that with tick bites, you have to have tweezers so that you can pull off the tick. Doxy, as we all know, is the first line treatment for Lyme, but amoxicillin and ceftriaxone are good options for those who can't take doxy for whichever reason. And we definitely need to think of non-Lyme disease with tick bites. There is a ton of other OSIS diseases, and that's why when people come in with non-specific symptoms, we've got to ask about tick exposures for 2 months or so before this starts because of the longer incubation period. The short of what you said is basically that if we don't think of it, we will never diagnose it because it can be very non-specific and will only be diagnosed with the specific PCR tests. For West Nile virus, it comes through mosquitoes, but it can also come from transfusions and transplants. And with West Nile fever that's caused by the virus, it's just a non-specific febrile illness. It can also have a neuroinvasive disease, and that's the one that comes with like meningitis, encephalitis, acute flaccid myelitis. It's super scary. Again, you need to suspect it so that you would treat it, which is supportive, but also there's a lot that can be said for preventing it.
Exactly.
Well, moving on to our new feature of critical decisions, which is called critical pediatrics, non-accidental trauma. And although this is a sad topic that I don't like to talk about, and I'm pretty sure not anybody likes to talk about this or listen to it, I am actually glad that we are mentioning it more and talking about it more over the past few months in critical decisions. It's a can't-miss diagnosis since many victims present to the emergency department with non-lethal injuries prior to the fatal incident. And there's a ton of risk factors that are related to the patient themselves, to the child, so if they have developmental delays or behavioral disorders, or related to their caregivers, if they have substance abuse, psychological disorders. But it's definitely important to remember that they can happen to children in any background or situation. When somebody comes in with an injury that's concerning, such as bruises to the torso, the ears, the neck, the cheek, the mandible, the eyelid, the sclera, that doesn't necessarily happen often in kids. Take a moment and think, can this be non-accidental trauma? Also remember, those that don't cruise don't bruise. So if they can't walk and they can't get around, it doesn't make sense for them to be bruising and quote unquote falling.
Yeah, exactly. So bucket handle fractures can occur accidentally, but they are the most common finding with non-accidental trauma, child abuse, because of the mechanism comes from a forceful twisting or pulling. And this shearing force causes a fragment that is wider at the edges than at the center, which looks a little bit like a bucket handle.
The workup is going to be dependent on the age and the verbal capabilities of the child. Any child that's less than 2 years old, you got to do a skeletal survey. In high-risk cases, you may also need to do a second skeletal survey. We've talked about how a babygram is not sufficient. You can't just take one image of the kid under x-ray and just call it a day. You have to actually x-ray all of those bones. A CT head is preferred if you're having asymptomatic head trauma, and some patients are best suited for an MRI if you want to increase the test sensitivity. You must get head imaging in any infant that's less than 12 months old, and if you have any suspicion for head injury. C-spine injury is also something to think about, and we talked about this in a prior issue. Unless they're having any other neurosymptoms or anything like that, x-ray can be enough. And definitely do a fundoscopic exam, which we are not pretending is not challenging, but must be done within 24 to 36 hours.
Obviously, we are always going to involve social services to perform home safety evaluations and provide the families with resources and support. It's important to remember that their involvement doesn't necessarily mean that the child will be automatically taken from the parents. But if we are highly suspicious or concerned about immediate threat to the child, then we should advocate for the removal.
And moving on to a very similar topic, it's covered by our LSA review. So for this month, we're actually reviewing the article by Miller and McCaw named Intimate Partner Violence that was published in the New England Journal in 2019. In this article, they mentioned that a third of women and men have experienced intimate partner violence in their lifetimes. So who are most at risk and what are the potential health effects?
Well, it's most prevalent in young adults age 18 to 24. And there are also a lot of at-risk populations, including sexual and gender minorities, those with mental and physical disabilities, racial and ethnic minorities, and particularly, of course, women of reproductive age and their children. The victims of intimate partner violence may actually end up being non-adherent with their general medical treatment since the abusers use control tactics and can interfere with their ability to seek medical care. And they end up having higher rates of chronic conditions, PTSD, anxiety, substance abuse, and even suicide. The children involved and exposed to this also have higher likelihoods of physical and mental health disorders and may actually experience intimate partner violence in the future.
So what can we do in the ED?
Well, we definitely play an important role in screening for this, and we want to do this in a safe and private setting, and also be ready and capable of connecting these victims and patients with social services if they're ready to seek them.
That was definitely an important reminder of a very important topic, as we've talked about quite often actually in the past few months on critical decisions. So take a look at the LSA review and maybe even the original article.
So your favorite drug apparently is midazolam, but my favorite drug is phenobarbital. And the drug box this month is on the use of phenobarbital for actually alcohol withdrawal.
That happens after you take all of my midazolam and you run out of it and you need phenobarb.
No, not necessarily. So the drug box reviews that it's a barbiturate that acts on the GABA receptor just like benzodiazepines like midazolam, and, of course, alcohol, the original offender. It has a longer half-life than benzos, which lends itself to a kind of a self-tapering effect. And there's also some evidence that's maybe less addictive than Valium. So one study showed that those who were given phenobarb for their alcohol withdrawal had lower rates of ICU admissions without any differences in adverse events like respiratory depression. You can give it two ways. I prefer to give it as a single dose, 5 to 10 milligrams per kilogram ideal body weight. But you can also titrate your dose by giving 130 to 260 milligrams every 20 to 30 minutes and titrate it up to the level of sedation, light sedation needed. You do want to avoid rapid IV administrations, and phenobarb can also have cardiovascular risk factors like bradycardia and hypotension.
I think that for those of us who have been practicing for a little bit, we remember having to reach to phenobarbital when we ran out of all of the benzos ever a few years ago for patients in alcohol withdrawal. So that was definitely a great tool to have in our pocket. And maybe that's going to be a topic in another critical decisions lesson of our benzo-resistant alcohol withdrawal. So I would like that t-shirt too.
It can be the back of the midazolam t-shirt. The front will say midazolam.
Ooh.
And then the back will say, if not available, phenobarbital.
I like that. Okay. All right. So now we got to work on these t-shirts as soon as we get off of this podcast, Wendy.
Sounds good.
And then last but not least for this issue, we have ToxBox, insulin overdose. And it's definitely a great reminder that the onset of hypoglycemia may be delayed more than 18 hours. And then the duration of recurrent hypoglycemia can be days, depending on the type of insulin, mode of administration, and renal function, which a lot of people tend to forget, including myself when I first started practicing, is that insulin gets excreted by your kidneys. So symptoms of hypoglycemia are going to include tremor, sweating, delirium, seizures, tachycardia, arrhythmia, because of that insulin overdose. And if you're not sure what happened there, you can measure the C-peptide to see and confirm that it was that insulin overdose. The treatment is obviously dextrose to make sure that people don't get hypoglycemics, and octreotide only if there has been a co-ingestion with sulfonylureas. I don't know if you call it co-ingestion because you never ingested the insulin in the first place. And in these patients, you rarely need to actually aspirate or excise the injection site. Well, Andy, thank you for taking the time to go through this issue with me. Our dear listeners, we hope that you have enjoyed listening to us as much as we've enjoyed recording this podcast.
We hope that you find the Critical Decisions publication and our podcast always informative, often enlightening, and never boring.
We would love to hear from you about your cases and hear about any feedback you have and any ideas that you want to share with us. Please reach out to us on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at Danya Koja.
Mine is at EM_NCC.
And until next month,
bye-bye.